The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
What's on my mind to talk about today is mindfulness, right mindfulness, which is kind of the heart of what we do here. And in doing that, a little bit talk about some of the things I've learned about mindfulness in the course of my practice. One of the things to consider about mindfulness is that that maybe mindfulness is like a tool, and it's a tool that can be used many different ways. And different teachers, different practitioners use it in different ways. Not only can be used in different ways, but it also can be couched in the context of different philosophies, different religious, spiritual practices or views about life. And in fact, in the diversity of different kinds of Buddhisms there are different contexts, philosophical contexts, religious understandings within which the practice of mindfulness occurs. And here, one of the aspects of, for many of the practitioners of Buddhism in the West, is that they have practiced Buddhism in different contexts, different religious Buddhist traditions, and in doing that, a lot of the teachers have, Western teachers. And in doing that, they've had to reconcile some of the different contexts within which mindfulness occurs, different philosophical contexts. So in my situation, I was introduced to things like mindfulness, attention practice, through years of Zen practice. And then I went, only after that did I go to Asia and Southeast Asia and Burma and to practice Vipassana, practice mindfulness in that context. And I had to contend with or deal with the fact that there was a different philosophical or religious view or purpose for which the mindfulness was being practiced there that was different from what I knew in Zen. And so I had to kind of do some reconciliation between the two, and that was a valuable thing. Other people in the different schools of Buddhism here, Western practitioners who kind of cross lines between different schools of Buddhism, have done similar kind of work. In fact, Joseph Goldstein, one of the pioneering teachers of our tradition, he did a lot of, after doing years and years of Vipassana practice, spent some time doing Tibetan practice and was troubled and had trouble reconciling the worldview of Tibetan Buddhism, the philosophy, and the worldview of Theravada Buddhism that he had spent time practicing with. And in his attempt to try to reconcile them, he wrote a book called One Dharma, which he kind of, I don't know if it's fair to call it reduced, but he kind of saw that the essence, what he saw as the essence of that they had in common of the different Buddhist traditions was the emphasis on non-clinging. And non-clinging, you know, he was content. That and partly he was content then because if you're not clinging to doctrines, then you don't have troubled by the fact that they're different. Perhaps. And that for him, non-clinging was such a powerful transformative effect that he felt that was enough, and you keep pointing back to that. Other Western Buddhist teachers, you know, have practiced with, you know, other Buddhist traditions and tried to, and everyone has to do this reconciliation. It's been one of the characteristics of Western Buddhism, the crossing of boundaries, that the boundaries that between different schools of Buddhism, which were so firm in much of the history of Asian Buddhism, have started to kind of dissolve or not be so strong here in the West, because so much came here in the West, and there's first time these kinds of encounters met each other. When I was in Japan in 1984, I think it was, maybe it was 1983. 1983, I was in Japan to study Zen there, and I was in Kyoto the first week I was there. And I was invited to go to a conference where, for the first time, I was told, two different schools of Zen, the teachers of two different schools of Zen, were meeting to have a conference talk about their practices, their philosophy. And for 1,000 years, or almost, these two different schools of Zen in Japan didn't talk to each other. You know, and they're, you know, there's a Japanese Zen, right? And so the idea of this much stronger demarcation of between Buddhisms, you know, historically has been a characteristic of Asian Buddhism. Not necessarily because they've been antagonistic, just sometimes it's been geographic distance between them. And even now in Asia, you find now, because of globalization and ease for travel, you find a fascinating interchange of different forms of Buddhism and influence of each other. That is nice. I don't know, when I went to that year I was in Japan practicing, I went to one of the more, for the purposes of this talk, I'll just say, one of the more prestigious training monasteries, Zen training monastery in Japan. And I was eager to go practice Zen in this monastery, traditional Soto Zen monastery. And there are all these young monks there who are training, doing their basic training. And I'd left California and gone there. And these young monks said, "Gil, you have to read this book. You have to get this book in English, because they don't have it in Japanese. You have to get this book." And so I wrote to my mother in Los Angeles and asked her to go to the Bodhi Tree bookstore and get this book in English and mail it to me. And so here I was in Japan, right, studying Zen. And the Zen monks, the young monks at least, this is what they wanted me to read. It was a book by an Indian teacher named Bhagwan Rajneesh. Some of you know him. Talk about eclectic on many different fronts. So they weren't telling me to read Zen. They were this kind of Hindu New Age, you know, guru from India they wanted me to read. And so this crossing of boundaries is one of the characteristics. So again, back now to the topic of mindfulness. So mindfulness is a tool, and a tool can be used many different ways. And I think it's helpful to see it that way and then become more conscious about what are we using it for, what tool are we using it for, and also, more importantly, what kind of maybe philosophy of life that we're holding it within. So one of the another characteristic that of the Vipassana movement, this Western insight meditation movement, that in the early years that I was part of it in the 80s, was the Western teachers felt very reluctant to use some of the language or ideas in which the mindfulness was couched in Thailand and Burma. And they were very explicit about this. And also some of the traditional Theravadan language from the suttas going back to the Buddha, they were very shy to use. And so one of them, for example, was you find in Southeast Asia a lot of emphasis on the defilements. And they were very reluctant to use the word defilement, because in their minds, these Western teachers, their minds, this was very aversive. And it was derogatory. It was like criticizing something. And if you have defilements, then you're, in their minds, it was like, then you're bad in some way. And they didn't want to have couch the practice in words that lend themselves, for Westerners at least, to see something like original sin, or see somehow they're unworthy or bad. So there, you know, maybe in this Western context, the words defilement had a different impact on people than maybe they had in Thailand and Burma. So they were shy to use it. And they would use words like, instead of defilements, which seemed kind of, you know, critical of oneself, I know one teacher used the word torments. Now, this is how you torment yourself. Doesn't mean that you inherently have defilements. It's just that you're defiled. It just means that you're troubling yourself. And so And then there were language of like killing the defilements or killing the hindrances. And there were a lot of language words like this, kind of, there were negative kind of connotation words. And so in America, people didn't want to use that. Perhaps sometimes it's because in America, they say, there's a strong philosophy of being world-affirming, life-affirming. And so you want to have language that's more life-affirming, because that's the context for the West here. And in fact, some Asian Buddhist teachers have been critical of Western teachers offering mindfulness in a life-affirming way. And if you look at some of the writing of Buddhist teachers in the West, Vipassana teachers, is often the purposes of practicing mindfulness is often presented in ways that benefit you in this life, in how you can live a more healthier life, a stress-free life, a more beneficial life, a more compassionate life. Some of the things, like some of the teachers have talked about, you know, if you practice mindfulness to its end, you can live more compassionately in the world. So that's nice. But in contrast, some of the Asian teachers say, if you practice mindfulness to the end, you'll cut off the defilements. You'll never get reborn. And the whole idea of never getting reborn doesn't, you know, some Westerners believe in that, but it's not something that grabs a lot of Westerners. Like, they don't come running to practice at a place where they're going to get off the wheel of life and death, right? But that's a traditional way. And so we begin offering a different philosophy, a different approach. And when does the different approach somehow lead us astray from what Buddhism traditionally been about? And when is it a healthy adaptation for our culture and our way? Are you following me a little bit? I didn't mean to go on so long like this. So then, my own experience. So, as I said, I began in Zen practice. And one of the... And they didn't use the word mindfulness very much when I practiced Zen back then. Now they do it because it's become a popular word. But we practice attention. We practice being present in an attentive way, which is one of the ways of understanding what mindfulness is. And we did a lot of it in Zen. I spent a lot of time in the meditation hall, sitting in Zazen. And one of the ways that I sat was, the idea was just to sit without any goal, without trying to do a lot, except just to fully be present. And I wasn't given a lot of tools to change myself, to improve myself, to get rid of anything. I was just told, be fully, completely present for your experience, for what's going on there. And so I spent many, many hours, days, months, in this very still, quiet room, sitting upright in a very dignified posture, keeping my eyes open, trying to be fully, completely there. And what happened then in doing that? It was very powerful for me to do that. One of the things that happens is I discovered very quickly how poorly I could do that. That I had all kinds of agendas, all kinds of things I wanted to do, all kinds of things I wanted to prove, all kinds of ways that I wanted to be seen by other people, all kinds of ways that I wanted to prove myself. And so to sit there, try to just be present, I would rush off to try to do something. And it kind of functioned like taming a wild horse, where, I don't know if it's the best analogy, but at least one idea of taming a horse is you have a stake in the middle of the corral and you tie a rope to the horse, and the rope can only run round and around, and it just runs wild and bucks and stuff, but it can't go that far, and slowly, slowly it realizes that it's tied up, and it begins kind of becoming quieter and quieter, and then the horse trainer comes up and can approach it. So the rope and the stake, for me, was sitting upright in a dignified posture with the idea of not doing anything but be fully present. And off I would run, buck and protest. This can't be good enough. It has to be more. I have to be able to do something. How am I going to be great and famous if I just sit here and do nothing? How can I avoid my distress and my suffering if I just sit here and I'm open to it? How am I going to fix myself? And how am I going to be the great Zen practitioner? And I had all this stuff that went on, and even if it was about the practice, but I had other agendas about my life, and so my mind would spin out. It was hard enough to be present, so my mind would spin out in thoughts and fantasies and ideas and projects and all this stuff. And so the practice of coming back and just being present, coming back and being present, my breath and my experience here, was in a beautiful way for me, a taming of myself, taming of the wildness or the unruliness or a lot of the attachments and desires and wishes and fears that I had that kept me spinning, my mind spinning and running off. They all kind of settled, a lot of them settled down, because they weren't being fed. I wasn't going along with them. And as I settled down, sitting in this very peaceful, quiet room, I discovered that this being fully present, this dignified full presence here, was very satisfying, was very meaningful. That there was a sense of, a very powerful sense of aliveness and freedom, just to be here. And it, you know, none of my education growing up, my conditioning, had taught me that just to be alive and present in a full and clear way, without accomplishing something, doing something, proving myself, having something, getting something, being something, would be meaningful. But I found it very meaningful just to be there and to be alive. And actually, I felt more alive in this kind of way than I actually did being busy in my life. And this also was kind of maybe almost like a paradox. How can you be more alive doing nothing? But actually, for me at least, when I was doing things, it was too easy to succumb to my neurosis, too easy to succumb to all the different ways I drain my energy, trying too hard, trying to protect myself, trying to prove myself, concerned about success and failure, running away from things, chasing after things. There's all these things that the mind does, right? Those are draining. But when I wasn't doing those anymore, it was wellspring or this reservoir of energy and aliveness became stronger and bigger, and it stood there in a very powerful way. So much so it became almost like a power inside of myself, or kind of a presence within me that became stronger and stronger. And the presence of attention, the presence of awareness, the presence of presence, kind of inner sense of being alive and here and attentive, would stand out in such strong highlight that when my mind started to go out in fantasy, my mind started to be concerned with trying to get something and want something, it was no longer interested in chasing after those, following after those. They started to pale in importance. They're kind of like not so interesting anymore, because I had something much more interesting and much more valuable that was right here. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know, maybe the best analogy for it would be, you've been walking, walking with a shoe that has a nail poking up through the sole into your soul for a long time. And finally someone says, you don't have to do that. Here's a shoe that doesn't have a nail. Wear this. And so you wear that, and so then you're not so interested in putting on the shoe that had a nail anymore. So why would you get involved in fantasies? Why would you get involved in desires and contractions and fears when it's kind of, uncomfortable to do that, when you have something much more comfortable and meaningful right here? So that was something very important that I learned through Zen practice. And so what it taught me was the value of presence, of being fully here. It also taught me the value of getting out of my way. And I learned through Zen how much I got in my way. And one of the ways, in terms of meditation practice, was I got in my way by trying too hard. So here's an interesting thing I told some people recently. If you try to be a really good Buddhist practitioner and try to do it really right, some people are really important that they do it right, because heaven forbid you do it wrong. If you do it wrong, that's like really bad news, right? And, you know, it's like you can't do it wrong. So if you take meditation practice, you do it exactly right, whatever that is, right? No one knows what, but you do it exactly right, it'll probably take you twice as long to get enlightened. That it's probably designed, this whole thing, that you find your way not by doing it right, but you find your way by kind of going off a little bit. And then you make a correction. You go off a little bit, you make a correction. And so you go back and forth. And so one of the ways we go off is, that I found got off, was I try too hard. I try to be the one who does the practice. I'm the agent of practice. I'm just going to apply myself harder here. I'm going to use all my great brilliance to figure out exactly what to do and do the wonderful engineering project of, Buddha's inner practice. And it's up to me. And of course it's up to me, and of course it's up to you, but if you're too caught up in the world of self, being self-conscious in it all, you'll tie yourself in knots. It doesn't work. So a big part of what I learned through being present and noticing how I was how not to be so self-conscious in my practice, not to be involved with measuring how well I was doing, not being the one who has to be successful, not be concerned about the one who's failing. I failed brilliantly in my practice at times. Wasn't so brilliant, but one of the great failures, I'll tell you, failures in Zen, now I look back happily, but I failed so miserably, I was in tears. I cried, and so it's a sad story. So you ready? So I was a relatively new Zen student. I was sitting Sesshin, which is this one-week-long Zen intensive meditation retreat at Green Gulch. And the custom back then was they had last sitting in the evening was open-ended, didn't end until the abbot came. What they did was it kind of ended, and then they'd serve this wonderful hot drink. And the idea was the hot drink was going to fortify you to stay up late into the night meditating. So they serve the hot drink, and then you sit there waiting until the abbot comes. And the abbot back then was going to read a little poem or recite a little poem or a little teaching, and that would cap the day, and then we go to bed. So you're sitting there, you had your drink, and you're sitting there cross-legged, and the abbot didn't come. But you couldn't move until either the bell ended the sitting or until the abbot came. So you sat there and sat there and sat there. It was a long time. I don't know how long it was. I had no idea how long it was, except I was in pain. My legs hurt. They were burning. They were aching. They were searing. They were in so much pain. And they weren't ringing. I was saying, ring the bell. Bell, anything, you know. But you can't move. So I was so hard. So finally, I collapsed. I gave up. And I said, oh. And it was in the most undignified, unzen posture you can imagine. And I was sitting right in front of the door. And at that moment, the abbot walked in. And because my ego and sense of self and, you know, the abbot was kind of a father figure for me, you know, and all this stuff. And it was like, I had failed. I had let down. And so I made it through the whatever was next, and then I went to my room and cried. So leave yourself alone. So don't be the agent, you know. And so it's okay to fail. It's okay to fail in front of the abbot. Now I know that. I didn't know that then. So all this selfing that goes into practice and into oneself. So learning to leave oneself alone, not interfere with one's practice, not interfere with one's experience, was a powerful lesson. So how to be there in the meditation, be present, upright, dignified in a certain way, but don't interfere with what's here. Anger comes. Don't interfere. Let it be there. Let it be there. Fear comes. Let it be there. Sadness comes. Let it be there. Discomfort happens. Let it be there. Around you, things that shouldn't be happening are happening. People are noisy. The person next to you has Velcro jacket and puts on and off and on and off. They shouldn't do that in a Zendo. They shouldn't. This not. But you sit there with it all. Whatever's happening, whether it's agreeable or not agreeable, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, whether, you know, you sit there. Sit there and experience it, let it go through you. And I learned how not to get caught by things and involved in things and resisting things and wanting things to be different. And it was really powerful for me to have this. It didn't involve doing anything. I wasn't like trying to make something happen. It was mostly I was trying to get out of the way. So this was a really, really important formative experience for me and how I understand Buddhist practice for me was this idea. So when I went to Southeast Asia and to Burma, that's not the message I got for how to practice mindfulness. The message I got there was work hard, strive, really kind of bear, almost like, not bear down, but really be really diligent And mindfulness was more like a technique. You do this, you keep looking, and a lot of you let go, you have to learn what to overcome, you have to develop your concentration, you have to develop these different capacities, you have to let go of your defilements and your hindrances. In Zen, I didn't let go of hindrances and defilements. They let go of themselves. Because I would just sit there and not get involved. If I was defiled, if I had greed, I would sit there with the greed. Not to be more greedy, I wouldn't sit there and indulge in it, but I would sit, get out of the way, and just be fully present for that. And with full presence for greed, allowing it to be there, but not being involved in it, I found my freedom. It would fall away. So that message I did not receive when I was in Burma. There, if you had greed, you had to cut it off, you had to stop it, you had to let go of it, you had to do things, do this, all this stuff to try to overcome it. And when I listened to my Burmese teacher, it just was sound like too much doing, always doing something. And so that was one of the things I had to reconcile, was this way I'd learned to be mindful and present in Zen with how to be mindful and present in the way I was being taught in Burma. And so I had to negotiate that, those two worlds. And the way I found it for me was I decided when I was going to follow the instructions that I was given as carefully as I could. I was a pretty diligent student learning the technique he was teaching of mindfulness, of insight meditation. But I was going to do it in the spirit or with the attitude with which I was practicing Zen. And what that meant was that I was going to continue practicing being fully present for this experience right now without trying to change anything, without trying to interfere with anything, just be fully there for it, try to accept everything as it was, in a sense. But I was going to, with the insight practice, I learned, using those practice and techniques, I learned to do it better. Because what I learned was that through this practice of insight meditation, with the care and the precision that it has, I saw that in a general way, in Zen I learned how to be present and accepting and with my experience in a good way. But when I looked very in little micro movements of my mind and the subtlety of my mind, there was still a lot of non-acceptance, still a lot of interference trying to make something happen. And so I used the Vipassana practice to help me get into the subtlety, the depth of my mind in a way that was very, very meaningful for me. So that's how I reconciled the two. As I did this Vipassana, more intensive mindfulness practice in Burma, very intensive, I learned more about the value of mindfulness and presence. And one of the things I learned was not only to... In Zen, I learned how to be just stay present for things. In Vipassana, I learned to be present, but also to go into them more deeply, look at them more carefully. And so another way of saying this, it's kind of like in Zen, I sat upright with an upright posture, had my presence, and my body was kind of like the broad container that will let the energies and feelings and thoughts just be there. In Vipassana, I did that as well, but in Vipassana, I also learned to bring my attention and place it right in the middle of whatever I was experiencing at the moment. So if I was feeling pain in Zen, I would just sit there, let the pain just be there in an open way. In Vipassana, I would bring my attention and bring it very close to the pain to really feel it carefully and closely and to have the intimacy with it. Or if I was feeling sad, I'd feel where the sadness was in my body and I'd bring my attention right into where that place was. I'd be really close to it. Sometimes bringing myself right to the middle of where I feel the sadness, and then I would rest there. I'd relax. Just be there with it. So I was still practicing presence. I wasn't trying to change anything, but now I was doing it in a different way where there was an intimacy and closeness to the experience that was more close than that when I was practicing Zen. And what I learned there is that if you get really close to something and really into it, very, very present for it, that... Much of our inner life that we experience will begin to process itself, unfold for itself, resolve itself. So, for example, if I am angry, The approach of the teachers I studied with in Burma was cut off the anger, let go of the anger, develop your concentration so your concentration is stronger than the anger. But what I learned was that if I go bring this intimacy to my anger, turn towards it, sit in the middle of it and feel it, allow it to be there, that the anger would begin to change. And that the way it changed was always meaningful, was always trustable, was always valuable. Because, so for example, I might discover the anger would begin to open up or become clear, clarify what the anger is about. And I would see that the anger itself, maybe, was arising out of fear. So there's layers, right? So there's fear. And it was valuable to discover the fear. If I had just let go of the anger or overridden the anger, I wouldn't have seen the fear. Maybe I would have seen it later on, maybe, but anyway. But then I learned that, okay, that's good. Now let's go into the fear. And if I stayed there very close with the fear and let the fear relax, then I might see the fear was connected to the desire to be safe. The desire to be safe is not so bad. Maybe that's a nice desire, instinct to be safe. And so then I would go and feel that desire to be safe and rest in that. And it, resting in that and opening, letting that unfold, it would open up to maybe to a feeling of safety or contentment or ease that had been threatened a little bit. And then so this layers of starting with anger and follow the trails down, the layers down, to this place of feeling safe or feeling love or feeling freedom that might be there. And I found that going through that and letting things unfold that careful way and going through these layers, I learned over and over again that I could trust being present for anything. And that I didn't have to look at anything at all in my heart, my mind, my inner things going on as something that was wrong or bad, a defilement that had to be cut off or killed, but rather something that could be transformed if you went into it. And lower and lower. It takes a lot of equanimity, it takes a lot of presence, a lot of attention, it takes a lot of good qualities to do that, but they kind of come along with it. So then from that came a philosophy, kind of a philosophy, that is a little bit, I wouldn't say it's world-affirming, but a little bit more welcoming to everything we have, as opposed to unwelcoming, saying that shouldn't be there, we have to overcome it. We want to overcome the way we're not free, we're caught by these things. But the way to become free, I found, was to go into it and transform it. So as far as I can tell, this has not been a strong part of traditional Theravadan Buddhism in Burma and Thailand. I'm sure you find places where that's taught in that way. But I've learned it partly from bringing this Zen background and combining it with the Vipassana. Other teachers here in the West have learned the same thing from a little bit they've inspired from their contact with certain kinds of Tibetan Buddhism, where they have the same idea that you go into something and transform it. It becomes compost out of which something beautiful can flower. And so you take energies and take difficult things. You take desire, you take lust, and you don't reject it, but there's a way where you wisely go into it and use it to transform it and change it into something else. Also, one of the ways that the Western Vipassana teachers have learned this kind of approach, those of you don't come from the same kind of Zen background as me, some of them learned it from Gestalt therapy. And this is maybe one of the lesser known influences on Vipassana in the West, is that Gestalt was big in the 1970s. And some of the Vipassana teachers studied Gestalt, and so a little bit inspired. Oh, you can turn towards things in Gestalt and feel and be present for it, and so that was another influence on this. So what you find much more here in the Western Vipassana teachers, the way they teach mindfulness, is they teach much more mindfulness in this kind of not a way that wants to reject or cut off or see things as being wrong or bad or defilements. Certainly they recognize the problems of not being free and the problems of clinging. But the way to become free of clinging, one way, it's many ways, one way that is emphasized in this Western movement is you turn towards the clinging and get to know it carefully and well. And you're not in a hurry to cut it off or let go of it. If you let go of things too quickly, you might not learn what's there. And if you let go quickly, you might reinforce an idea that can be harmful to you, which is that you're in charge. I managed to do it. Look at me. I let go. And I've seen a number of practitioners who have been successful, relatively successful, different aspects of Buddhist practice by applying themselves, and they apply themselves with their ego, their self-identity, their conceit, intact. And they come out the other way, in some ways benefited from the practice. It's good. But also more conceited than they were before. I've seen that sometimes. And it's, you know, but it's okay. Remember I said you don't have to do it perfectly. Because if you keep doing the practice of mindfulness, of attention, being present for things, and that's dedication, you don't rest on your laurels, but keep practicing, then the practice is self-correcting. Then you'll see the problems that you have from having gone a little bit astray in your practice. So it was beneficial, but you got a little bit more conceited. You get to sit with that, and you get to kind of, you know, if you sit carefully and mindfully and really sit with your conceit, after a while you'll feel like this is not comfortable. This is not so useful. And then you'll want to let go of the conceit. So it's self-correcting. So you don't have to do it right. And you don't have to be critical of people who are a little bit off course. You're going to be off course soon enough. but keep practicing. Keep bringing attention. Keep letting the mindfulness, the attention, the understanding, the seeing what's there. So that was my attempt today to offer you one approach to how mindfulness can be done. Mindfulness is a tool that can be used in many different ways. It can be held in many different religious views about what practice is about. And this is not meant to say that others are wrong or not as good. But it's useful, I think, to get a sense of many different... there are many approaches, and I offered you today an approach that was very useful for me and has been important for me. But it's not the only approach that I use, so don't think that, you know, this is it. Okay? Is that okay? Thank you all very much.